Psych Podcast, the podcast where my dear colleague Paul Bloom and I discuss everything having to do with intrapsych. Paul, welcome.
Nice to be talking to you again, David.
I'm excited because we've finally reached the area where you are the expert.
Finally, after me faking my way through various topics or something I know a smidgen about, and it's developmental psychology.
That's right. Well, there is this meta conversation that we could have about the real imposter syndrome that comes from teaching probably an intro class in any field, because, of course, we are taught to specialize and we narrow and narrow our areas of expertise. So taking on a class like this, a project like your book, does become sometimes an exercise in humility. And this podcast is, I think, an exercise in humility for me. How do you feel when you finally get to the area that you know so much about? Do you find that this is an easier thing to talk about or a more challenging thing to talk about?
It's a good question. When it comes to writing the chapter on development and also lecturing on it, I find it much harder because when I'm talking about areas I know less about, well, there's some really interesting things to say and I kind of rattle them off. But when I get to my own area, so much more complicated.
That's right.
Than you might think. And you know, the issue of humility, actually, just to stick to it for a little bit, writing a book like this required me to delve into fields which I have, you know, I have some acquaintanceship with, but I'm hardly expert. And you know, I'll just say two things. And also our conversations. You know, you know stuff I don't know. I know stuff you don't know. But there's some stuff we're going to be talking about that neither one of us is purely expert at. And one thing is, we both get a lot of help from other people. When writing my book, for each of my chapters, I found at least one person who's really expert in that area. For my clinical psychology chapter, for instance, which I'm not an expert, I had like four or five trained clinicians look it over. And then the second thing is, and I still make mistakes. I'm sure there'll still be mistakes, and you know, you it's inevitable. And you just try to fix them when you have a chance. And to the extent that we make mistakes here, we'll try to come back and fix those.
Yeah, and I think that part of the love of teaching these topics, it's driven, at least for me, by a desire to get people to be excited, to love the topic that I love.
Yeah.
Nowadays, so much information is at your fingertips. I find that teaching can't be just about conveying information. The challenge is really for me to excite people about it.
I think that's right. I often struggle when I teach intro psych to ask, you know, what exactly am I trying to do here? And it tends to be many things, but one thing is to try to convey the excitement of the field. Another thing is to convey some big ideas, big discoveries, big perspectives, and maybe less so, you have to memorize the specific study.
Right.
For one thing, they could, you know, people could find out the studies themselves, but for another, any specific study might turn out to be false or simply become irrelevant as the field progresses.
Yeah, and there are very few ideas as big as this. How do we go from the blooming, buzzing confusion? I know you hate that characterization. I hate
that blooming. Sooner or later, somebody's going to call my book a blooming, buzzing confusion, because as a reminder, my last name is Bloom.
I would love that. But the question about development is such a fascinating one. Anybody who has seen something like a human infant go from being a newborn all the way to being an adult, it's incredible what happens.
Yeah, it is incredible. It's, you know, we're talking a bit about the sociology of the field. And let me complain a bit. There are parts of psychology that get more respect than others. So neuroscience, computational work, the stuff which involves big machines and flashing lights and so on. And of the fields of psychology, the subfields, developmental often doesn't get much respect. It is often, you know, we're not the most paid members of the department. Our conferences are not the fanciest. And the New York Times doesn't trump our results as much as it trumps other fields. And I think that's a huge mistake. We could talk about why the mistake exists. I think part of it is sexism. Many people in my field are women. Most development psychologists are women. Raising children's traditionally been women's work, and people might think the study of children is women's work, and as such, it gets less respect. We're not as high tech as other fields, and everybody likes the fMRI scans and the flashing lights. But whatever the reason, it's a huge mistake, because developmental psychology deals with these questions of extraordinary interest. So one is the one you just mentioned, which is you look at a baby and you wonder what in the world's happening there. What's the baby think? What's it like to be a baby? And they're the closest we could come to honest, like aliens. But then they transform into us, and developmentalists are interested in how that happens. Developmentalists are interested in the question of destiny. So to what extent is one's fate already decided when they're born? Developmentalists are interested in ultimate questions like, where does morality come from? Where's the origin of good and evil? Where does knowledge come from? And not only do we ask the big questions, but, you know, there are some real, real cool discoveries. I think some of the greatest discoveries in psychology come from the laboratories of people who study babies and children. So that's my commercial for the area I study.
It always seemed a bit odd to me that we settled on these subdivisions in psychology, because when you look at developmental psychology, many of the questions, say, that I'm interested in, like morality and emotion, questions that are central to cognitive psychology, like the nature of memory or how we come to categorize objects or how sensation perception works. It's very important, I think, and informative to view those through a developmental lens. Developmental almost seems like a tool to answer some of the big questions.
That's interesting. I think that's sort of half right. Or one way to look at developmental is a tool, study kids, as a way to explore other questions.
Maybe I'm just using you guys to answer my questions.
No, so often you have a team of social psychologists and they sort of want to drag in a developmentalist to sort of say, how does this thing we're worried about emerge in children? And in this way, developmental psychology is a lot like neuroscience. Because why is neuroscience a special field? Suppose you're really interested in racial prejudice. Well, you might be interested in it from all sorts of ways. You know, how does it emerge in a society? How does it differ from men and women, people from different groups? How does it develop in kids? And then you want a developmental psychologist to answer your social question. Where does it exist in the brain and what are the neural processes and so on? So developmental in that sense could be just a tool. I think it's a little bit more than that, because there also are sort of specific developmental questions. And it's the one you actually started off with, which is how do you get cognitively, socially, emotionally from being a baby to an adult and what happens? So a lot of developmentalists are interested in development per se. Personally, I've been mostly interested in my career with what does development tell us about other issues like moral psychology or social cognition.
And what it tells us about cognition is where it started, right? Is it fair to say that Piaget is the founder of what we might call developmental psychology?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's sort of scholars might say, oh no, what about von Rubenfeld, in Hungary in 18. There's a lot of developmental psychologists around, but Piaget is of the status of a Freud or a Skinner. Piaget established this big picture theory of cognitive development that proved to be extraordinarily influential. I think it's a rich and powerful theory. I don't think it's right, but I think it's rich and powerful. And he made so many discoveries about the baby's mind and child's mind.
And the way that he was approaching the questions and what questions he was approaching have stood the test of time. Very few academic psychologists study the interaction of the superego and the ego.
yes.
But the things that Piaget wrote about, they still do.
Yeah. Yeah. Piaget was interested in phenomena like babies' understanding of physical objects. Do they? And he came up with this wonderful proposal, which is that babies lack object permanence. When an object is out of sight, for a baby, it no longer exists. He said this is why peekaboo is so much fun, because they think the person has actually disappeared and is reappearing. He has findings about children's difficulty understanding appearance versus reality. He has some very famous set of studies involving children's failure at what he calls conservation. And here's one of his studies, and I'll say it because it works. You could really do this. You sit with a three-year-old, and you put candies, like M&Ms, like four candies in front of the kid and four candies in front of you. And you say to the kid, okay, who has more candies? And the kid will look at it and say, they're the same. And then you spread out one of the rows. Now, if you choose an adult, the adult will laugh. It's still the same. You haven't changed anything, really. But kids have problems with this, and they tend to say, oh my gosh, now you have more. And what's going on there is a matter of a lot of debate, but it's a real phenomenon. And this is to Piaget's credit for discovering such things.
Believing that faces disappear, that candies magically increase in quantity, it really must be great. Either great or horrific to live in the magical world of the mind of a 2 or 3 year old.
It's an interesting question, actually, whether a 2 or 3 year old or a baby is living a good life. Are they happy? Alison Gopnik, who's a wonderful child developmentalist in her own right, argued that the life of a young child, because children lack the neural structures to focus on things and to attend to things, and they're basically prisoners of whatever experiences they have. And it's kind of rough for them. Like if something's bothering you, like you're hungry or you're anxious or you're somebody's capturing your attention, you could like say, oh, that's interesting. You could focus on it. You could say, oh, well, it'll be better in a little while. But kids just experience. And I think this is why they often scream.
Oh, well, that is very horrific.
She gives the example, I think, of being in a new being a tourist in this, and you're dropped in this market in this foreign country, and everybody's babbling and they're bumping into you and they're screaming, and you have no idea where you are and what to do. Now imagine that, but also imagine you have no real memories you can go back to, and you can't think about the future, and that just sounds awful.
And you're barely in control of your physical movements.
That's right. You can't. And that's right.
Sounds like a night out on the town, really. So Piaget, well known for his stage theory, he's also often associated with what we would call the nativist approach, which is the belief that we come into this world with knowledge. But his view really is more complex.
It is. You know, we saw a stage theory before with Freud. And it's kind of, you know, rated R, you know, anal stage, oral stage, polymorphous perversity and everything. Piaget had a perfectly G-rated stage theory where the kid starts off with a sensory motor stage and concrete operations, all these sort of logical and conceptual structures built up. And Piaget saw himself, and one of his appeals was that he fell between the extremes of a sort of hardcore nativism that says everything's pre-wired. He definitely didn't believe that. He thought that a lot of our knowledge that we have now is an accomplishment of a long developmental process going through these stages. But he was also not a simple empiricist. He certainly had no truck with behaviors. He believed children had pretty complicated cognitive capacities for learning and for developing. They developed these mental structures called schemas, where they sort of thought to make sense of actions and the world. So his was a very cognitive theory. Right now, if he was around, he'd probably have a computational model of how it developed. And the way, you're exactly right to say that he could be seen as pushing back against empiricists, because he was quite nativist in certain ways. However, I think what happened through the history of developmental psychology is a lot of people pushed back and said that Piaget wasn't nativist enough. So, for instance, Piaget said kids have no understanding of the physical world when they're born, when they start off. That's a very, it takes years and years to understand that unsupported objects fall or that objects persist when they're out of place. And then there's extraordinary studies finding that even the youngest of babies know all of this.
Piaget, as you mentioned, was a polymath. We would probably call him a genius. And he was trained in biology, right? Or zoology?
Yeah, he did his first paper on mollusks, like when he was like 12 or something. He was this crazy genius. And you know, in some way, he was, unlike Freud, unlike Skinner, he sort of stayed in this lane. He studied kids. He didn't have these grand pronouncements about mental illness or cultural evolution or origin of religion. He just studied kids. But he was not a humble man. And he actually had this broad research program that he called genetic epistemology. And genetic meaning the broader sense of origins of, and epistemology being knowledge. He wanted to know, how does a species like ours come to develop knowledge? And he believed that you could study this species question, this culture question, by studying children. That in the mind of any individual, from being a squalling baby to a full-grown adult, sort of recapitulates, sort of just goes over the same sequences as our species. So he had big ambitions with his developmental project.
He really, in some ways, could be considered the founder of moral psychology.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I feel you and I are both deeply invested in.
You know, you say he was a bit arrogant. I don't know if you remember, but my mother studied with Piaget in Geneva.
Really? Any good Piaget stories?
Well, she did say that he always mocked Skinner, thought he was an idiot.
come here for the gossip.
This is something you mentioned in the book. He did think that it was an odd American obsession to ask how we could make our children develop faster.
That's right. Whenever you know, a developmental psych professor, an intro psych professor gives the stages, we associate them with ages. And the ages are just approximate. And Piaget would, like you say, when he went to America, people would ask him, how could we make our kids whip through these stages faster? It's very, very stereotyped, you know, American in question now.
You know, you still see this to this day, parents obsessed about, well, my child hasn't started crawling yet. My child hasn't started walking yet. And say for cases which a doctor would probably diagnose, children don't fail to learn to walk.
Yeah. But they have different paces, and parents, understandably, and I remember when my kids were young, get anxious when they don't hit a milestone soon enough. But Piaget, it's part of the sort of humanistic guy he was sort of very cheerful about development. He honestly loved children. He loved to observe children and write about children and think about children. And the idea of childhood as something to be rushed through was really anathema.
And this is why I always remember that his background was in biology. It makes more sense to understand his approach when you think about the development of biological organisms, where That's the right. process unfolds. It just simply is, you know, you plant a seed, a tree grows, the information is in the seed, but it needs sunlight, it needs water, and the tree will just grow. And I think that's very much the view that he brought to development. He was interested in the mechanisms, what was going on when it was growing, but that you could somehow improve what's going on, the process, making things grow faster. I think it would have been a foreign idea.
Yeah, yeah. One question which always comes up when we talk about this is nature versus nurture. In that conflict. And I'm curious, and because every psychologist has a different answer to this question, but when you teach intro psych, what do you say about nature versus nurture?
To be honest, I try not to say it. Usually will come up about halfway through the class, and I'll say something about the phrase nature versus nurture, and I will try to brush it aside. But of course, that's in the back of everybody's mind whenever you talk about any of this stuff. You know, talk about it. Personality, intelligence. I explicitly talk about behavioral genetics, that subfield which is interested in which psychological properties are inherited. And I guess I just avoid it.
Yeah. You're right to point out, by the way, there's sort of two separate questions. And the question we're talking about now involves universals of psychology. Like, where does language come from? Where does reasoning about objects, an understanding of other people, come from in all humans? The second question, which is something which is worth discussing elsewhere, is about human differences. So why is it that people are different? And for each of the questions, you could ask, what's the role of environment and what's the role of genes?
It's a good distinction to bring up here, because I do think that people often confuse one claim for the other. That is, if you say that the way that children acquire their concepts of the physical world is through learning, and so you're an empiricist, people often do assume that you must also mean that differences come from environment.
One example of this is that a lot of people agree with Noam Chomsky, I do, that we have a fundamental innate capacity for language learning. And this is why every human who doesn't undergo terrible circumstances or some sort of genetic problem comes to know one of the world's languages. And that's a very nativist position. But the specific language that you know, whether you know Hindi or Navajo or English or Dutch or Mandarin Chinese or whatever, that's a result of circumstance. That's not a result of your genes. And these things are totally compatible. that the universal could be built in, but the particular could be set by the environment and not genetic at all.
One of the things that you say in your chapter that I think is insightful is that we do tend to evade the question, but often psychologists will say, obviously it is this combination.
Yeah.
But there are some things that many psychologists actually believe are all, you know, or mostly innate, and some which they don't. And maybe that's one reason I avoid it, because the question isn't really about broadly whether everything is innate or learned, but sometimes it is specifically, is this thing innate or learned?
That's
is
right.
The way that we parse objects in the world, is that learned or not? And that might be a very different answer than whether or not we categorize gender in the same way.
I think that's right. I think I've heard so many people say something like, the nature-nurture controversy has gone away because everything's a bit of both. We should never talk in terms of one or the other. And I get the spirit of this. The spirit of it is that all of our capacity for learning has to be, at some sense, the product of genetic capacities. Humans learn, but rocks don't. And this is because our innate endowment. Equivalently, just about everything innate, hardwired, is somehow shaped by the environment. So we innately grow arms and legs, but if you don't get proper nutrition, that growth will be stunted. So plainly, everything's a bit of both in certain ways. But you then get really, the really confused thing to say is, oh, we can't talk about something being innate and something being learned. But of course we can. So to take an example I used in the behaviorist episode, I know all of the plots of old John Wick movies. This is learned. It is 100% learned. I wouldn't learn it if I didn't have a brain and I wasn't capable of learning. I didn't know language and all that thing. But still, it is 100% learned. There's no genes involved at all in that specific thing. On the flip side, I have blue eyes. That is not learned. Maybe environment played some role. Maybe I wouldn't have eyes if I wasn't exposed to the right sort of light or the right sort of nutrients. But still, and to make it more interesting, we could now argue, say, well, everybody, every society everywhere has some religion. People everywhere laugh at some things and not others. We find some things sexually attractive and not others. Are those learned? Are those hardwired? And even though there's going to be some interactions, I think those are good questions, which might have surprising and important answers.
You just reminded me, by the way, did you ever read one of my favorite Piaget books is The Child's Concept of John Wick?
Piaget wrote so many books. I would, you know, you had me for a while because I was going to confess I haven't actually, I've tried to read Piaget. He's a horrible writer.
I read The Moral Judgment of the Child. I think that's what it's called. I have no memory whether it was good or not.
But even then, like development of morality, Piaget argued that children start off thinking in terms of consequences. So an act is bad, just depending on what the consequences were. If somebody falls off a bridge, it doesn't matter whether they were pushed or whether somebody accidentally bumped into them. It's an equally bad act if somebody's hurt. And then later on, you get more and more sophistication where you take into account intentions and circumstances and so on. And Piaget is not wrong.
Right.
The developmental psychologists have given different analyses to this, but it does seem to be the sort of thing which he got right. And then other people explain it in different ways than he did. I think there's not many stage theorists anymore.
Right.
The notion of distinct stages has kind of fallen out of fashion. It seems to be more of a handy way to describe things, but not a good way of explaining things.
So let's move to modern developmental psychology. Even though there is no explicit talk of stages, most people don't endorse those. You look at modern developmental psychology, and here's a real question for you. All of the results are organized by children 18 months through 24 months, or 3 to 5-year-olds and 7 to 9-year-olds. The comparison between age groups is being made, but nobody wants to say that something happens somewhere between those.
Yeah, the great questions that remain, and you're entirely right to point this out, is there is developmental change. And, you know, so there's sort of two sorts of discoveries that come from our methods in development. One is we've developed some really clever ways of looking at knowledge in babies. I love this work. I think this work is, you know, I just look at people like Elizabeth Spelke, whose work I talk a lot about in my book, or Renée by Argent, have made discoveries about kids' understandings of objects, which are just amazing. And what they do is they use different methods like looking time measures, which monitor how surprised a baby is when something happens. So Renée by Argent found that if you put an object down on a table and a screen rises up and obscures it, and then the screen keeps going down, well, you'd expect, an adult would expect the object to block the screen, so it would clunk. But if it goes right through the object, even babies are surprised, suggesting that they believe the object remains. And there's so many studies like that, finding that there's rich understanding early on. So there's all of that. We could talk about that for hours. There's all of the discoveries of what babies know. But then there's real developmental change, where there are things that four-year-olds know that two-year-olds don't. And some of them are like facts. That's sort of not surprising that a four-year-old, you know, an older kid might know more color names than a younger kid, might know more language, might know, might develop skills like riding a bicycle or whatever. That just makes sense.
Right.
But there are things that young kids, and this is Piagetian insight, that babies and young kids have struggled with. And then they get better at later on, become adults. And if calling them stages, say, oh, we're going to explain this by saying the younger kids in stage A and older kids in stage B, that doesn't do much for us. But we still have to explain it. What happens? You know, is it brain maturation? Is it some sort of restructuring of knowledge? Is it having the right experience? You know, those are real puzzles.
And I guess maybe one of the dangers of too much stage talk is that people take the stages to somehow be the thing that is causal.
That's right.
There is some sort of reification would be the fancy way of saying it, but you will hear that children at this stage are different than children at the second stage. So you think, well, why? Well, because they moved stages.
Yeah. And absent any theory of what makes a move from stages, you're just re-describing it. You're like saying, there's stage one dumb and stage two smart.
I'm still stage one. You know, by the way, one of the things that I had this realization about was that my mother used to often talk to us about the stage that we were in. And I had no idea who Piaget was. It wasn't until I got to late high school and took intro psych, I ran to my mother and I said, oh, this is why. And I think I must have said something ridiculous to her, like, you know, he's famous, right?
That's such a college kid coming back to his mom to explain something. There are apparently, I've heard stories of kids in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where there's a lot of universities, a lot of developmental psychologists, and, you know, kids will fail some basic task and then turn to their parents and say, well, I'm just in the concrete operation stage. You know, what do you expect? When you give to charity, how much impact will your donation actually have? This question can be hard, if not impossible, to answer. Most charities just don't tell you how your money will be used or how much good it will accomplish. You may know it could theoretically help a cause, but how? Or more important, how much? If you want to help people living in poverty with evidence-backed, high-impact charities, I recommend you check out GiveWell. GiveWell spends over 40,000 hours each year researching charitable organizations and only directs funding for a few of the highest-impact, evidence-based opportunities that they found. Over 100,000 donors have used GiveWell to donate more than $1 billion. Rigorous evidence suggests that these donations save over 150,000 lives and improve the lives of millions more. And using GiveWell's research is free. GiveWell wants as many donors as possible to make informed decisions about high-impact giving. They publish all of their research and recommendations on their site for free. No sign-up required. They allocate your tax-deductible donations to the charity or fund you choose without taking a cut. On a personal note, this is my first time on a podcast. I was delighted that David agreed to do it with me. And given that this is connected to the sort of educational program we have, and we take it very seriously, we decide to be extremely picky with ads. We particularly want to steer away from ads that made comments or our suggestions that we were skeptical about. Maybe if we do another podcast, we'll be less principled. But this time we decided to go principled. And I know David 100% agrees with me. Well, I'll say for me, this is, I think, the only advertisement I would take, because I believe in the principle of altruism and intelligent giving that GiveWell is associated with. I take their cause very seriously. I'm actually very proud to be representing them. If you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donations matched up to $500 before the end of the year, or as long as matching funds last. And to claim your match, go to givewell.org and pick podcast and enter psych at checkout. Make sure they know you've heard about GiveWell from psych to get your donations matched.
So you touched on one of the big changes in developmental psychology, in the emergence and in the creation of better methods to try to answer some of these questions. And I think it helps to go back and talk about exactly what Piaget was doing. And Piaget was sitting and observing in a way that I think is a very rich method for collecting data about what's going on. And I remember actually at Yale, when I first took a developmental seminar from Steve Resnick on infant development. And one of the assignments was to go to a daycare, and we were assigned a kid, and we had to every week go and observe and take notes. And you think, well, I've been around kids my whole life. You know, I've seen babies. But it does unlock a whole lot to sit and just really pay attention to what's going on. And that was his method, right? He looked at his own kids a lot, and he looked at other kids, but he didn't have much more than that.
He would look at kids. He would look at other people's kids. He was a very keen observer of his own children. And there's a great intellectual history of this. Charles Darwin has a wonderful article in the very prestigious philosophical journal Mind called something like A Biographical Account of an Infant, where he took his first son, William, and tracked William's emotional and moral development, these wonderful stories. And I think we learn a lot from this. And then Piaget did experiments of a sort where he would often show children different things. Like he would pour liquid from a short wide glass into a tall narrow glass, and then ask them, is there more liquid now or less? And then when they would answer, he would question them way more than contemporary development psychologists would do. Question them, record their explanations, record their accounts of the world. And in this way, I think he learned a lot about kids. And I kind of agree with you. I think any developmental psychologist should spend some time talking to children and watching children. I think in the wild, as it were, you know? And I think that it's indispensable for learning about their minds.
I think it's indispensable for most psychologists. You know, I think a lot of social psychology would be helped out by some systematic observation. And you mentioned Darwin, and I recall he was interested in this question of the universality of emotion. He would go to his funerals of his relatives to observe their facial expressions.
God, I love Darwin. Yeah, to have the patience to observe. And I think sometimes we can make great discoveries by seeing people in the wild, seeing what they do. Darwin would also observe himself. You and I are both interested in disgust. In fact, you're one of the world's leading scholars on this mysterious emotion. And Darwin has this wonderful story. He's in Tierra del Fuego, and he said, a native touched some cold preserved meat with his finger and was disgusted at it. And Darwin's watching this, and Darwin says, I felt disgusted at my food being touched by a naked savage, though his hands did not appear dirty. And he's sort of introspecting on himself and his own feelings and everything.
Being first introduced to British food must be quite an experience.
Wait till they had the breakfast.
Is it fair to say that as developmental psychology refined these methods, that what we've discovered is that Piaget's estimates of when development occurred were just shifted a little late, because if you're relying on children to tell you something or to even be able to perform the physical actions that are required to respond in some general way, maybe you're missing something.
Yeah, even those of us who study adults find that often adults are very bad at describing why they believe what they believe or what's going on with them. And it's so much worse with kids. So I agree with your point about that these methods of Piaget were indispensable. But at the same time, the problem they all had was they lead you to underestimate how smart kids are. And so you use these more sophisticated methods involving looking time, involving in some ways, sometimes actually looking at neural responses to things, reaching studies, all these sort of clever studies finds that even before kids could speak, they seem to have a sort of rich understanding. You know, so just take one sort of simple example. You know, you might talk to kids about gravity and what they think about falling objects, and probably it's just a mishmash where it doesn't sound to know anything. But you could do a study with pretty young kids where you hold up an object and then you release it in front of them, and it stays in space because there's a hidden wire keeping it up there. It's a basic magic trick. Now, if kids really have no understanding of gravity, they should just find that boring. If whatever's still floating, who cares? Of course, at the right age, kids are shocked. They look longer. And that's something you'd never find from an interview method or an observation method.
The modern methods of, say, measuring looking time, I can't not ask you to give a brief overview of these methods. The boring babies, the surprising babies.
Yeah, there's a lot of different methods. So very quickly, I'll just talk about a few of them. One method is, and basically all of these methods employ something babies can do, which is they can move their eyes. And so one simple method, for instance, is you want to know when do babies understand words. And so, you know, you wait a while and say, do you know what dog means? But you're waiting a long while before they can answer that. So Roberta Golenkoff and Kathy Hirsch-Pasek did a series of lovely studies where you sit a kid in a high chair and there's two screens in front of the kid, one to the kid's right and one to the kid's left. And then poof, on the screen, there's a dog on the right screen and a shoe on the left screen, for example. And from a speaker comes, ooh, dog, look at the dog. And what you'll find is at a certain age, surprisingly young, the baby's eyes will turn to the dog. So that's preferential looking.
They don't say, like, why are they showing me a shoe and just stare at the shoe? They said dog.
That's true. So sometimes the results get complicated because babies are very noisy creatures and noisy in both senses of the term. But they tend to obediently look at the thing that that matches the word. There's actually a really nice study, by the way, showing abstract thought of a sort. In babies, where it's the same sort of design, but on one side there's two circles, on the other side there's three circles, and babies hear bump bump bump, and then they turn to the three, or if they hear bump bump, they turn to the two, suggesting that they have maybe an abstract notion of number. So that's preferential looking. Another one is surprise. Babies look longer; they stare at things that surprise them, like you would too, like that the example of the gravity violation. A third thing, which is a little bit related to surprise, is what psychologists call habituation, which is a fancy word for boredom. And the idea is that if you see the same thing over and over again, you'll get bored. And from a looking perspective, you start to turn away. So what you can do is, for instance, you want to know whether babies can tell red from green. Perfectly good question. So you show babies a series of red things, and they start to watch it, and they start to look away, get bored. And then you show them a green thing. Now, if they can't tell the difference, if it's all the same, they'll just keep getting bored. But if they perk up and start to focus, that suggests that they are telling the difference. I'll tell you, by the way, we're talking about looking time things, but there's other things babies can do under control, even very young babies. And one of them is sucking on a pacifier. So they have some control over this. So there's some very classic studies where they take kids who are, born to English-speaking families. And just at the moment they're born, you put a pacifier in their mouth, headphones around their ears, and when they suck on a pacifier, they hear English in one condition, and in another condition, they hear Russian. And what you find is kids born from English-speaking families will suck harder to hear the English than the Russian. If they're born to Russian-speaking families, you get the flip result.
You know, there is this feeling that I get whenever I hear about these studies which is hard to describe. It's an aesthetic sense, which is, damn, that's clever. There is a talent to trying to figure out how to solve some of these problems.
Oh, yeah.
The first time you hear these, you're just like, wow, that is a way to answer it. And it's a way that Piaget didn't have.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. You know, one way to tell the story of psychology is to tell in terms of different theories. And that's sort of what I'm inclined to do. And I think is also sort of your inclination as well. But we could also tell in terms of methods. And every field has its methods. The behaviorists had their, running rats in a cage. The Freudians had their free association, their dream analysis. The developmental psychologists have their looking time and sucking things. Your field of social psychology has some extraordinary methods. Some, for instance, methods involving reaction time, how quick you are to press a button that are said, and we could talk about what these mean, but are said to sort of measure implicit bias, what you think of black people versus white people say. And the neuroscientists have their methods of scanning, blood flow in the brain or electrical spikes of activity. And these methods have given us real insights into things we wouldn't otherwise know.
I think it's also worth talking here about one of the problems with novel methods. For every method that we come up with, there is always the concern that even though we are getting systematic results, that maybe they're not what we think they are.
Yeah.
And so you bring up one possibility in when you're trying to figure out whether children can keep track of number. It's hard to know whether they're keeping track of something other than number.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So babies can distinguish between a picture of three cats and a picture of two cats. And then you say, wow, they could tell two from three. That's amazing. But maybe three cats takes up more space than two cats, typically. And sort of just saying bigger space, bigger filled out space and smaller. So that's easy. You just make the cat smaller. So that the three cats, three small cats, two big cats. But now maybe they're just responding to big cats versus small cats. And you go bananas trying to control for this. And then sometimes you get a reliable response and it's not clear what it means. So one of the interesting findings of babies is you take a baby raised by white people and then you show it two faces, a white face and a black face. You equivalently do this with a baby who's raised by black people and you show them the same two colored faces. And maybe you also do a baby who's raised in a multicultural thing with both. And what you find pretty reliably is babies will be drawn to stare at the face that matches the color of the people that they were used to. Now, you could then say, and I've heard this result described as, wow, babies are kind of a little racist. Mm-hmm. The people raised by white people are drawn to they prefer white people. But is it really a preference? They like it more? Or is it just an orienting to something that's more familiar without any sort of emotional weight?
Right.
It's hard to tell.
That's a good example. And it's an example that carries over into social psychological methods of reaction time, where most of the debate isn't whether or not these results are occurring. It's about what they mean. Speaking of methods, you talk specifically about one method that was developed by a philosopher, or that was, proposed by a philosopher, the false belief task. And the reason the methods conversation spurred this thought in my mind was because you wrote a critique of the use of this particular method. And it's one of my favorite papers of yours. I don't know if you know this, but...
Thank you.
I always found it such an elegant paper and a forceful critique. This is a widely used task, and it is also so clever.
It is very, very clever. And this paper was with a Tanzan German many, many years ago. We were not the only ones to write about this very controversial, very, very interesting task. So this was in the middle of a debate over how much chimpanzees know about other minds. And so what people were saying was, what if you have an experiment with this where somebody walks in and puts a banana in a box and then walks out, and then they come back in, where will the chimpanzee expect them to look? You could use looking time measures to see where they expect them to look. And if they have an understanding of other minds, they would expect them to look in the box. But then critics say, well, but what if they don't know anything about minds? It is in a box. So maybe that's to just expect you to go to where it is without ever getting to somebody's head. And so the philosopher Dan Dennett came up with this really clever idea. So here's now a new scenario. Somebody walks in, puts a banana in a box and leaves. And then while they're gone, someone moves the banana from a box to the basket, also hidden. And then the person comes back. Where will they look for the banana? Now, this is the false belief task, because now you have to judge somebody's behavior based not on how the world is, but how it is in their head. And when chimpanzees fail, there's some debate over how well they do, but most studies find that they fail. They think the person's going to look where the banana actually is, not where they should believe the banana is. They will look in the basket, chimpanzees think, but not the box. Four-year-olds fail. Five-year-olds succeed. Four-year-old humans and five-year-old humans succeed. And this is taken as sort of the gold standard of understanding other minds. The gold standard of understanding other minds is that you know another person can believe something that's false. And this is actually essential. For me to lie to you, for instance, involves me putting a false belief in your head. For me to play hide and seek properly involves me trying to hide somewhere I think you're not going to think I'm at, and so on.
Oh, and you're underselling it, because this so-called theory of mind, the understanding that other people might have beliefs other than yours, underlies all of social interaction. It underlies communication.
That's right.
Every time we speak to each other, we are making some inferences about what we meant with the firm belief that there is something that you meant in your mind that you're trying to communicate.
That's right. Everything rests on this theory of mind. So just like objects are like a test of the physical world, what do we think of the physical world? Beliefs and desires are the stuff of the social world. And this clever method where children fail at has been used to defend the idea that there's a huge transformation in development where younger children, up until about the age of four, don't really have a full understanding of other minds. They can't grasp, and this is Piaget's idea too, they can't grasp the idea that other people have minds that are different from their own.
Which is very consistent with the other finding that you're talking about, intentions versus consequences in moral judgment.
Yeah.
If little Johnny tripped and knocked over a vase versus he got up and pushed the vase over, if you don't understand that it matters,
that's right,
that he had an intention in his mind to do it in one case but not in the other, then of course you can't make that distinction.
And it's consistent with other observations too. Like young kids are really bad at hide and seek. So they'll often like stick their head under something with their butt sticking out. And you think, like, how could you believe that I can't see where you are? But they're also terrible at lying. You know, the cliche, but it's been studied experimentally, is that kids of the sort who would like eat chocolate chip cookies, have them smeared all over their face and say, I didn't have anything. As if they don't understand how to lie.
Right.
And so the claim is that there's some sort of revolution, great transformation around the age of four, where suddenly they have the understanding of other minds. Some people say the transformation is due to neural development in certain parts of the brain. Some people say it's caused by the exposure to the right sort of language, somehow reconfigures the brain. And then there's people like me who thinks that actually maybe kids actually can reason about false beliefs when you make it simple enough. And there's a lot of debate in this field. It's probably the most contested area, the emergence of theory of mind in all of developmental psychology.
So you point out that you may be just measuring whether or not people can suppress their own knowledge.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And even when I tell the story, there's one person, the box and the banana and the box and the basket, it gets moved to the basket and everything. You see it, like, even for an adult, it's a little bit hard. And when you make it difficult enough, even adults falter. It's such a natural default. People look to where the thing is. It's a hard task. And then if you have easier tasks, kids do well. Here's a very cute little task you can do. You put something in a box and you hand it to a two-year-old. And you say to the kid, like maybe it's a little doll. It's in a box. You say to the kid, show the doll to your mother. And kids do something which seems obvious. They turn the box so she could see the doll. But doesn't that imply that they understand that she doesn't immediately know what you know? Like, if kids were as ignorant as you, as Piaget would say they would be, they would just stare at the doll and assume the mother would pick it up. But they understand that you need to orient things towards another person for them to figure it out.
Well, that's because they've been reinforced to do that, as we learned.
Well, you're kidding. You're giving me a hard time, but that may not be entirely wrong. There are other explanations for why kids. Sometimes you say kids are really smart, and then someone else could come and say, no, they've just been taught how to do that.
So the moral of the story is it's difficult to know. But I think it's safe to say that children know things and can do things a lot earlier than what Piaget might have thought.
Yeah, I would think that if I had to sum up, if I had to list maybe the five big discoveries of psychology, and I haven't tried doing this, but one of them would come from developmental psychology. And I'd even put it in stronger terms than you did, which is, a lot of our knowledge about people, about objects, about causality, about number is built in. It shows up in babies as early as you can test them. And that is a startling finding. It is still controversial in some circles, but I think the evidence by now is overwhelming. And it is against Piaget, and it is against a lot of people's common sense. It doesn't preclude, of course, there's an enormous amount of learning that goes on. But still, a lot of the stuff is hardwired. But that leaves us with the question that you were raising before, which is, so how do we explain when kids change, differences? And some of it is just accumulation of knowledge. You just learn. You pick up. There's a lot to learn in this world, and you pick it up. Some of it may have another source. And maybe we could end with this, because it has a personal resonance to me, because this is an idea first defended by, in some form, by Piaget, developed by Annette Karmeloff-Smith. Piaget's collaborator and colleague, and I think developed mostly by my advisor in graduate school, Susan Carey, which is that you could see the child not as a collection of hardwired modules, like a nativist might see him, not as a sort of blank slate, as an empiricist might see them, but as a scientist, having some built-in understanding, really smart, but trying to develop correct theories of the world, and doing experiments on the world, trying things out, seeking things out, being curious and doing things. And from this perspective, Susan Carey drew upon the work of the philosopher of science, Thomas Kuhn, who talks about scientific revolutions, where you go from one scientific theory to another. The theory of Newton to the theory of Einstein. The theory of the pre-Darwinians to Darwin's theory of evolution. And she argued, and I think to some extent this is probably right, that one way to make sense of the fact that children think so differently from adults is they have different theories of the world. And in her work, and in the work of many people, including sometimes me, people try to delineate how the different theories can be. Like, you and I have a theory of death. You and I have a theory of animals, of biology, of social relations and everything. And the claim would be for each of these domains that children start off with a different theory and gradually converge upon the theories we have.
I like that approach, because it captures at least my observation that children are constantly interacting with the world. And I mean, I think Piaget described it this way as well. They're doing things to the world and seeing what happens. And you can see that if you observe a child enough. The world is their lab, and they're manipulating things systematically.
That's right.
And sometimes they really are surprised.
That's right. And you know, the cases we tend to think about are the physical exploration. Kids love playing with blocks. They love playing with pools of water and sand. And you watch a kid, again, intently doing things, watching how things fall, watching how you balance things. And what you see there is a sort of powerful computational mind network just building up these things. But the kind of maybe more more personal side is they're also experimenting with people. And, you know, and so one theory of the terrible twos is that kids are basically not just doing experiments on you know, toys and food. They're doing experiments on their mothers and fathers and their siblings. And so the child who all of a sudden takes a handful of Cheerios and throws it in your face is actually at some level thinking, how will he react? What do people do in those sort of situations? Let's explore. Let's do an experiment. Let's repeat the experiment several times. See what happens.
That is a hilarious way to characterize, I think a very charitable way of characterizing it, but it adds to the horror of what childhood might be. You know, that I never thought of it that way, but I also think that captures even later on the phenomenon that you get where children just don't seem to know what's funny.
Yeah.
And so if you hear a child tell a joke, it is as if they are saying things because they know that sometimes people say things and the response is this very pleasurable laughter, but they don't quite know what to say. And you can see their little minds working.
Yeah.
They kind of get sometimes the structure, right? I know that the joke has this structure, but they don't quite understand why there's a punchline.
No, kids' jokes are often funny because they're so horrible. A friend of mine, the philosopher Jerry Sammet, there's so much talk of the child as scientist. And so he gave a talk called "The Child as Mad Scientist." And he talked to all the crazy ideas kids have, the crazy theories of the world. You know, the one I remember, actually, I was raised in Montreal, and Montreal had a dense network of highways where you go under underpasses and overpasses. And somehow I had in my head that the city had two levels, and a bottom level and a top level. Even though that makes no sense, because one level, the bottom level would be dark, and it wasn't, but I thought the city had two levels. Also, I heard my father once just said somebody got fired, and I thought it meant he got shot. And I went through many years of my life where I thought that when you ended a job, they shoot you. So you know, and you're just trying to make sense of the world, and turned out both of those are wrong.
I'm glad that you didn't rigorously test that second one. Well, I think that's a great place to end it.
I think it is.